Welcome to Mondays with Millie, a podcast about the past with real relevance to the present day. I'm your host, Phil Christofaro, and in this podcast series, I interview my 90-year-old mother-in-law, Doreen, who I affectionately call Millie, about her ordinary life and the extraordinary events which influenced it. Millie has witnessed firsthand some incredible things across 10 decades. This is a personal history which gives us some perspective about life's triumphs and challenges. A kiss, a cry, our rights, our wrongs, a moment of love, a dream, a laugh, a moment of love, a dream, a laugh, so stay there. Welcome to Season 8 of Mondays with Millie, the decade of the 2010s. As we click over more than 4,500 listens across 30 countries, we welcome listeners from India, Norway and Sweden. In Season 8, we'll explore Millie's life as an octogenarian. After losing JC in 2006, Millie spent the next few years getting used to her own company. JC's best friend, Tom, was a close friend of Millie since 1960, and they decided in 2013 to move in together, providing mutual support to each other socially, financially, and emotionally. Please enjoy this episode of Mondays with Millie. A moment of love, a dream, a laugh, a kiss, a cry, our rights, our wrongs, a moment of love. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Episode 1, Season 8 of Mondays with Millie. This episode's titled Tom. Now, you might have heard us talk about Tom in previous episodes and refer to him from time to time. And we're going to dedicate this episode to Tom today. So, Millie, who was Tom?
Well, Tom was John's best friend, my husband's best friend, and they worked together, did their training as design draftsmen together at British Aerospace. And when we were married in 1960, he chose Tom to be his best man, and they remained firm friends ever since, even though Tom spent quite a few years in America and also South Africa. Working, you know, designing aircraft, they always remained very close. And, you know, when Tom, when John was in the last phase of his life and on an oxygen machine all the time, Tom and another close friend, Bob, they each used to come down once a week separately and stay with John for a couple of hours so that I could go out and do some shopping and without having to hurry back. And they were very good friends right to the very end, you know. And just before John died, you know, we were chatting, and he never talked about dying, you know. I don't mean that, nothing like that. Just never acknowledged the fact. But he said to me, you know, I don't want you ever to lose touch with Tom because he's very lonely. And so I said, well, why would I do that, you know? And it was just left like that, you see. And then, of course, John died in 2006. And then in 2013, Tom got, he lived on his own for 35 years. His marriage had broken up, you know, quite early on. His wife wanted to marry someone else. Tom never found anyone else. He was just content to work and live by himself, really. His children had all grown up, three children, so he didn't have any problem, you know, he didn't have any responsibilities there. But in 2013, it was while I was out visiting you around Christmas period, he developed bowel cancer. Well, it was rectal cancer, to be exact. And he had to undergo treatment for that. He was quite ill for a while. But actually, previously to that, the year before, he had a heart attack. And they put a stent in. And from then on, he was fine. He ignored the fact that he had a heart attack. But the cancer situation really got to him, you know, he was quite ill. So when he started to recover, well, he was still having treatment in Preston, you know, in the cancer centre. And I said to him, he was looking very thin and he wasn't looking after himself. He really wasn't well enough to. So I suggested that he come and stay with me for a couple of weeks. Which he did. And then he said, well, I think I'll sell the house. It was three bedrooms, you see, his house in Thornton. He said, I think I'll sell the house and I'll look for a little flat in St. Anne's. So I said, well, that's a good idea. So anyway, while he was staying with me, we looked around and we looked at one or two places, newly built places, you know. And he kept saying, oh, no, I don't like that. No, I don't like that, you know. So at the end of the 2 weeks, I didn't say, well, are you going home? He said, I was thinking, suppose you and I both sell up and I come and we buy a place together. And I said, no, that won't work because... whoever dies first, it means our children are waiting for their small inheritance. It might be, but they'll be waiting until the other person dies. So that won't work. So I said, well, look, he said, well, could I come and live with you? And to tell you the truth, I was very hesitant. I got used to being on my own. But I loved him as a very dear friend, more like a brother, really. And he'd always been in our lives, you know. In later years, of course, we'd seen him every week, you know, and we'd take it in turns. We'd go to Bob and Barbara's or we'd come to our house. And we were always very close, the five of us together, you see. Bob, Barbara, Tom, John and I. So and by this time, of course, both Bob and Barbara had died. So anyway, in the end, I said, well, yes, we'll give it a try. Well, in no time, he'd sold his house. It went very quickly. Sold his furniture and moved in.
Made himself at home.
He started calling me his partner. And I kept saying to people, well, Not in that sense of the word, if you know what I mean. I'm not actually his partner. I'm just his very good friend.
What was it like living with him?
Well, he was all right, really, but he could be argumentative. And you see, John wasn't really argumentative. Oh, you know, John used to argue with Kirsten, because we're very like each other. They'd argue as she got older, but never anything serious. And we didn't argue very much at all, John and I used to get mad over the mess he used to make with his wine making and beer making. But that was different to arguing, you know. We didn't really seem very different from each other in a way. But Tom, of course, was Labour, absolutely red, staunch Labour. Exactly the opposite to me. And I said, we never argue about religion or politics, not with friends, you know. But he'd get an argument going first thing in the morning. You know, he was always up before me, and I'd come into the living room and he'd have the television on, and he'd say something to aggravate me about the government immediately. But really, he was a very nice man, and I do miss him. I do miss him. Yeah. But as far as anything I did for him, it was always very, oh, thank you. You know, it was always a thank you. He didn't take things for granted, let's put it that way. And he was very easy to feed. He really was. I didn't charge him rent or anything, but we split the day-to-day living expenses. You know, it used to be the rating system, but it was a community charge, which of course went up when he came to live with me. Because if you live on your own, you get an allowance, you see, for single occupation. So immediately that went up, and everything went up really. So he whatever the day-to-day living expenses were, he used to share with me, you know. So that was helpful. But
It worked out pretty well, but he did have his quirks, didn't he, Tom?
oh gosh, he did, yes.
Can you
And then of
explain
course
some of those?
it didn't help when he started to get dementia, which was it's very difficult, especially for somebody who's really very intelligent, and he was, no doubt about it. He'd had some really senior design positions and umpteen planes that he'd helped to design, you know. And right to the end, he could tell you all sorts about any plane that was on. He'd say, oh, that's a so-and-so, and you know the problem there, the weak spot there in that aircraft was this, this, and this, and you know. He could remember all those things, but he used to wander off sometimes. He'd tell me he was going to walk round the block, and 2 or 3 hours later, I'd start to worry, and he'd finish up probably getting on a tram going to Fleetwood, or going into Blackpool and having a wander around, or Thornton, you know. And invariably, of course, he left something behind. He'd lost two or three coats on the bus. He'd take his coat off and leave it, never get those back. And the bank got pretty fed up of issuing him with new credit cards, not credit cards, bank cards, because he'd lose them. He'd go in a shop and buy something, sweets or something, and then he'd have no card. He didn't know what had happened to it. So we used to have all those permanent worries, really. And one thing was quite, well, it wasn't amusing, it was upsetting, but after he died, of course, his bowling bag was there, you see, and his daughter, Pauline, she said, oh, Dad's bowls are here, how lovely. And when she opened it, there was only the small jack there. The two bowls had disappeared. And I said, oh, yes, he left those behind. I don't know. He'd gone away playing bowls with the local bowling club. And left his bowls behind, and he'd come home with his bowling bag with just a small jack in it. And when he went back the following day, of course, they'd disappeared. He never got those back either. So this was a continual thing, you know, losing things. But he'd always been absent-minded, you know. He
Well,
was
I
a
was going
real
to say,
absent-minded professor type.
he did have, he suffered from dementia in his later years, but he did have a bit of a habit of being absent-minded. What was that like? What sort of things would he do in that case?
Oh, crazy things, yes. Well, he once arrived at Bob and Barbara's in quite a state with a big lump on his head. And he was quite late arriving. And what's happened to you? And he said, oh, I won't have anything to drink tonight. I'm a bit confused. And I said, well, what's happened? Well, of course, he smoked. He didn't smoke in latter years, but he did then. He smoked and he dropped a cigarette on the floor in the car. So he bent down to pick it up and ran his car into a lamppost.
And banged his head, hurt himself. Yeah.
Yes, he did. Yes,
he was probably concussed, I was going to say.
Yes. Yep. There was always a story with Tom, you know. He'd even to things like trying to get on the wrong plane at different times. And it wasn't because he was drunk or anything. He was just in a world of his own most of the time. Thinking about something else, you know, and he'd hear a call for so-and-so and join in, and he'd be trying to get on the wrong plane, and all sorts of things happened to him, you know.
Weren't there a couple of occasions where you'd gone out and come home and the door had been left wide open and things like that?
Oh, yes. Mm. And I would lock the back door and the front door at night, and then without me realising, he'd go and open them up again for no reason, and open them wide. One night we had the back door open and the front door wide open, and I hadn't realised, you know. He did become very confused at the end. In fact, I remember a short time before he died, he wandered into the hall and he stood there sort of looking round, and then he turned and went into my bedroom. And so I got up and I thought, I wonder what he wants in there, you see. So I walked in and he didn't speak to me. So I just stood and waited, and he looked around and he touched a few things, you know. And then he turned around and saw me standing there, and he said, who sleeps in this room? And I said, well, I sleep in this room. I said, your room is at the back here. Because when he came, he'd so much luggage, shall we put it that way, he'd collected over the years. He finished up making practically a room in the garage. He'd got shelves all down the walls with all, and a big chest of drawers with all sorts of stuff in. So I gave him my bedroom at the back, which is the biggest room, of course, and I took the smaller room at the front, thinking he'd have room, you know. But I still had to buy, as you know, there's a big built-in wardrobe goes along one wall in the back bedroom, but that wasn't enough wardrobe space for him. So we had to go out and buy another wardrobe, double wardrobe, and another chest of drawers. And I brought two chests of drawers that were in the upstairs bedroom down. So he finished up actually with four chests of drawers and a double wardrobe plus the built-in wardrobe in that room. It's a good job it's a big room. And he filled it with all sorts of stuff, absolutely all sorts, you know. They weren't all clothes by any means. They were loads and loads of filing, box files, you know, dozens of box files, and with all sorts of work that he'd worked on, different aeroplanes and things. And he'd all this.
And he kept all that stuff?
Oh, yes, he kept it all, yeah. Mm. Kept it all.
He was a bit of a magpie then, was he?
Oh, gosh, yes, mm. Absolutely. Mm, he really was, yeah. But, of course, I didn't realise this at first, you know, because when we went to visit him, I didn't go up into his bedrooms or anything, looking through his stuff, you know. And downstairs, he kept his kitchen and his living room quite neat and tidy, you see. So, I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry that we lived together, because I found out, he used to go talking to the neighbours up and down the road, you know, And I didn't realise that. I'd think he was not being able to see, you see. And he'd stop chatting to different neighbours. And it was quite an eye-opener when he died, because different ones came. They were telling me how much Tom appreciated living with me and how good I was to him. And sometimes I wasn't good at all. I was quite naughty, you know. And I felt, oh dear. And he'd been telling all different people how wonderful I was and how I looked after him and how kind. I felt terrible, you know.
Oh, you were very good friends. And I guess, you know, I wonder whether it would have been really interesting if you'd been in your 20s. Like when we, you know, when we moved in with our friends, we were in our 20s when we lived in London. Yes. And, you know, we had couch surfers and people over and that sort of thing. And you just did it at a different stage of your life, didn't you? You did it later on.
I did, yes.
And it would have been...
And, of course, he was Catholic. I'd go to special services. I'd go with him. And he'd ask me to go with him. And I know... Soon after he came to live here, he started going to the little St. Albans Road Catholic church round the corner. And, of course, I went to my own church. And after he'd been with me a couple of weeks, the priest came round and he was just leaving as I arrived. I'd been out somewhere. And he just said, are you Tom's lady friend? And I said, well, yes, I am. And he said, I'm very pleased to meet you. And that was it, you see. So when I came in the house, I said, oh, the priest has asked me if I'm your lady friend. He said, yes. He said, he couldn't actually. He said, it's rather difficult to relationships these days, isn't it? I said, well, you know what he thinks, don't you? And he said, well, he obviously didn't mind.
Oh, what a situation. You should have shown him
the sleeping arrangements.
Oh, that's brilliant. Brilliant. And that concludes Episode 1, Series 8 of Mondays with Millie. Next week, we'll look at Part 2 of Tom, a great friend and support to Millie. We look forward to your company again next week. Oh, reckless abandon. Watching you. Mondays with Millie is an eLearn production. Editing and dodgy guitar work by yours truly, Phil Christopharo. Vocal work by Millie's granddaughter, Neve. A dream allows to stay there.